Westchester Talk Radio is broadcasting live.
News, trends, and more.
No one knows Westchester County better than we do.
We are Westchester Talk Radio.
Good day and welcome to Westchester Talk Radio, westchestertalkradio.com. I'm John Marino. We are produced by Shark and Creative, made possible by Entergy, the Indian Point Energy Center, supporting our communities right through April of 2021. Lipolis Electric, don't be left in the dark. Get Lipolis, Hightower, Westchester, managing your wealth through a fiduciary standard, and White Plains Hospital. Special thanks to all of our heroes at White Plains Hospital for all they have done throughout the COVID-19 pandemic of 2020. This is the Sports Report, and on the Sports Report, one of the things we do is talk to area notables here in Westchester in the sports world. Today we are talking with Andy Capion. Andy Capion is the track coach at New Rochelle High School, has been for many years, and he is a highly decorated track coach. His teams have won many a championship through the years, and they set the higher standard around just about throughout Westchester and the lower Hudson Valley in the Section 1 area of the Hudson Valley, which encompasses Westchester, Rockland, Putnam, and lower Dutchess County. Andy Capion, thank you for joining us here on Westchester Talk Radio. And by the way, I know your given name is Persio, P-E-R-S-I-O. How did Andy come about?
Well, growing up in Manhattan, when you hang out with your friends and they bastardize your name from Persio to Percy to every other derivative that you can think of, it dawned on me to be able to change my name. And being Catholic, I was able to change my name at confirmation. And I was influenced to use the name Andrew. And thus, I got Andy. In fact, I even changed it in my birth certificate from Jesus, which was my middle name. And I changed it in my birth certificate. It took a little while, but I got the Hall of Records and they changed it to Persio Andrew Capion instead of Persio Jesus.
Now, what part of Manhattan did you grow up in?
Well, there were several parts. I grew up in foster care, so to speak. So I grew up on the in the West Side. And then in East Harlem, I went to school on 97th Street and Amsterdam Avenue. But my mother, who had to kind of like give me up because she was a recent immigrant from the Dominican Republic, sent me to live with a guardian, so to speak. And I therefore moved around. When my mother got remarried in 1963, I finally got to live with her, and I was already in a ninth grade in 1963. Mm-hmm. So that's when I started living with her in Washington Heights. We originally lived on 177th Street, and then we moved to 157th Street between Amsterdam and Broadway. And that's where I spent the vast majority of my teen years, high school years, et cetera.
Were you born in the Dominican?
No, I was born here. My mother fortunately came here in 1947.
Wow.
She left the Dominican Republic to come here to seek her fame and fortune. And, you know, honestly, she struggled. She was a seamstress, got married and divorced. I was born in 48. She divorced my dad. And the result was she had to really struggle, didn't know the language, and gave me up, you know, to a woman that took care of kids. And I stayed with her till I was age 15.
Mm-hmm. Where in East Harlem did you grow up?
Basically 104th Street, 104th Street, just off Lexington Avenue. But I was still, in school on the West Side. So
97th in Amsterdam by the schoolyard where the great street legend, basketball star Earl the Goat Manigo played, right in the schoolyard.
Oh, he was more on 102nd Street, 103rd Street. In that area there, yes. I went to 97th Street. There was a school called Holy Name of Jesus.
Uh-huh.
A Catholic school. I was there from first grade to the eighth grade.
Uh-huh.
I graduated from there. I went to Cardinal Hayes High School in the Bronx. I used to travel from 157th Street in Manhattan, take the bus across the McCombs Dam Bridge,
right.
Let off by 161st Street, and I used to walk to 153rd and the Grand Concourse mostly every day.
Mario Ellie, the one-time Houston Rockets star, I believe, played in that schoolyard there, 97th and Amsterdam, too.
He did? Okay, I was long gone by then. I think he was from the 70s or something like that.
Yeah.
He went to Power Memorial or LaSalle or something like that.
I think he went to Power, if I remember right, and then played in the schoolyard there. I grew up near you, 107th Street and 2nd Avenue in Franklin Plaza, the projects there.
Oh, really?
Yeah,
imagine that. Look at that, John. Oh, so you were those Italian kids that we used to fight all the time.
Exactly. When I grew up there, it was mostly black and Puerto Rican. And the last vestiges of the Italian community there, which
I did not like.
Avenue 116th, 114th.
We still lost my Dominican heritage there for a while because everybody was Puerto Rican. I got to like all the Puerto Rican foods and things like that and the Cuchifrito places. Right.
I got a lot of Puerto Rican in my family, too. Good amount. Double figures, matter of fact, on both sides of the family through intermarriage. So I have a number of Puerto Rican cousins through marriage and who are half Italian, half Puerto Rican.
There's still a section over there near Pleasant Avenue.
Pleasant Avenue, still some Italians left. We still have the old feast there every year that you might remember from 108th Street where we lift the statue, the six-story high statue, and we still have that, the Feast of Giglio, every year in front of Rao's restaurant on Pleasant Avenue. We used to have it in conjunction with the Mount Carmel Parish there from
2000. Mount Carmel, I remember it well.
Yeah, for a number of years after 2000 now, it's done separately.
The schools are closed now.
What's that?
Some of those schools are closed now. I know.
Yeah, all those schools. I found out yesterday my grammar school, St. Anne's, my brother showed me online, St. Anne's from 110th Street, closed down. And so my high school, the old St. Agnes from 44th between 3rd and Lex, then eventually went to 87th and West End. That's closed down. My grammar school was closed down. St. Anne's was merged with St. Lucie's from 104th for a number of years. And now they are merged with St. Paul's on 118th Street between Lexington and Park. So St. Anne's still exists, but you don't go to St. Anne's at 110th between 1st and 2nd anymore. You got to go to St. Paul's between Park and Lex on 118th. So everybody and everything has moved around. And at St. Cecilia's also, too, was
the Knicks. That was our rival.
Yep. Deminger came from
St. Another part of it was Commander Shea.
Uh-huh. Yes, Commander Shea. Yeah, a lot of friends who went to Shea. Yep. Mm-hmm.
Dean Meminger came out of there. He was at St. Cecilia's, but he also.
Hector Camacho, Macho Camacho, the day of his funeral almost a decade ago. Now, my parents and my brother happened to drive through the neighborhood right up to the horse-drawn carriage carrying his coffin and waited there. And, you know, you say what you want about Hector Camacho. He did a lot of good things for the people and the community. No doubt about that. He bought houses for elderly people, whether it be, you know, in the Bronx or back in Puerto Rico. And I know a lot of things happened with him through his life and career, but in the neighborhood, he was a hero.
Yes, he was. In fact, he went to, when I started teaching, I was teaching in East Harlem. I first started teaching at Junior High School 13 on 106th Street in Madison. I wound up at Junior High School 99 on 100th Street, 1st Avenue. And then I wound up on 109th Street, Junior High School 117.
Yeah, right across the street from my building. Used to play ball in the schoolyard.
In that big schoolyard there.
Yes, you're a 117 guy. Give you a little trivia about that schoolyard. You know Johnny Williams, from the actor from the movie Goodfellas and the Pink Cadillac. Johnny Williams worked over at Salento's Deli on 2nd Avenue between 109th and 110th, and he used to make our sandwiches at lunch. And
that was the best sandwich shop in all of East Harlem. Yes.
It was Bellerin, who I grew up with from Salento's, and I are, you know, good friends to this day. We both went to St. Agnes, and we're both connecting again on Facebook with the St. Agnes Facebook group. We were talking about Salento's just a few days ago, and he thanked me for the write-up I gave to the Salento family and Salento's there. All you had to do was walk in and say, "Tuna works," and they knew exactly what you wanted, how to make your tuna sandwich. They made it pretty much the same way for everybody, and you get the old Italian Pasten brand of tuna, and just, you know, great days that we remember fondly 50 years later. But Johnny Williams was pretty much the best friend of two of my cousins, and they played on the same football team in the schoolyard every Saturday there, and he'd walk in with his number 53 on and white Packers jersey, and he was the center, and he walked in. When he walked in, you knew he had a presence about him. When Scorsese was looking to cast that pink Cadillac guy role, he couldn't find who he wanted, but he ate at Rao's all the time. So did Johnny, being from the neighborhood. And Scorsese was at his table at Rao's. Johnny walked in one Thursday night, I think it was, back there in the late 80s, just acting the way he does. And Scorsese said, that's the guy. Johnny had no acting experience, but you know, he's been a star now in Hollywood for 30 years, and great for him.
Rao's is that place right across from Manhattan Center. Old Ben Franklin. Yeah. And there's Patsy's over there about 190.
Patsy's, I grew up until I was about 5 years old. I lived in the apartment directly over Patsy's. My mother grew up in that apartment until we moved to Franklin. Spent a year on 108th between 1st and 2nd with my grandmother after my grandfather died. And then we already knew we had the place in Franklin Plaza. We were one of the first inhabitants of Franklin Plaza, first a decade and a half or so before we all moved to. All the Italians from East Harlem came up to Pelham Bay in the Bronx. And now a lot of the people who follow the Italians in East Harlem now come up to Pelham Bay as well, too. Everybody took the 6 train up.
And my favorite eating spot was Ponce de Leon on 116th Street.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Big Italian, a big Puerto Rican restaurant.
Right. Mm-hmm.
Yep. He could have played a role in Goodfellas, too.
Right. I know a couple of guys in the restaurants in the neighborhood who could have played that role, too. So you came out of the neighborhood. You came out of East Harlem, came out of the West Side. Where did you go from there? After what high school did you go to?
Well, I went to Holy Name of Jesus on 97th Street in Amsterdam. And I graduated from there. I went to Cardinal Hayes High School, where I played football, basketball, and I did track. Mm-hmm. So I did the 3 sports in those days. A lot of sports did not overlap as much as they do now. I only got to play up to my junior year to play basketball because by then varsity athletes, I was a 6'3" center in the Catholic League, and not good. When you're going up against guys from LaSalle who are 6'8", 6'9",
John Candelaria.
6'8", 6'9", yeah. John Candelaria was a little bit after me. LaSalle had a guy named Owens who wound up going
to the NBA, right?
He wound up going to the University of Wisconsin. It just wasn't good for me to go there. And then, besides, we had a new coach, Nick Workman, Seton Hall. He was the coach, and he said, if you're not here the first day of practice, you're playing football, there's no sense staying here. I got my starting 5 already. You know, I got my team. So I didn't go out my senior year. But
how did you feel when he told you that from a motivation standpoint? Gee, I can't even have a shot to start. Not my fault that the football.
I didn't even have a shot to even sit on the bench that when he came in.
Well.
Which is what I did all through my junior year. I sat on the bench, you know, like I wasn't playing because they had a guy who was starting on the team by the name of Tony Morgan, who wound up playing at Iona, of all places. He was 6'5". And then the next year, my senior year, we had a guy that came in. He was 6'7", 6'8", Gene Doyle, who wound up playing at Holy Cross. He had a big famous game against Lou Alcindor at the Garden when he played at Holy Cross, and they played UCLA, and Alcindor came in and scored something like 37 points, you know.
But Gene Doyle was staying around the block, right?
He was already starting at center, you know.
Right.
So I only went in if I did get into the game my junior year was to foul people because I was a football player, you know.
Which you could do in those days, intentionally foul people.
I used to foul people. I was a foul trouble in the first quarter some games. Uh-huh. You know, 3 fouls already. You know, don't let that guy get the ball in the paint.
Right.
You know.
Right. Uh-huh. And how about football? What position did you play? Lineman in football or tight?
I was a tight end.
Tight end. Uh-huh.
I was a tight end. Yeah. Not a very good tight end. I didn't have much speed, but I had good hands. And I could block, so I played tight end, defensive end, that was led me to go play some after high school. I went over to college in Iowa, where I played at Parsons College in Iowa
mm-hmm.
for 2 seasons. before injuries and everything caught up to me and the lack of a scholarship. And I decided to just be a student.
Right.
Catch up to my academic qualities. And there was no track program in Parsons. So I wound up just doing, you know, intramural stuff and things like that. And I didn't graduate from there my senior year. I had 15 credits short, and I transferred my senior year to NYU. And they took away 15 credits that I got D's in while I was in Iowa. And I spent the full year at NYU, where I graduated in 1972.
And what was your major, your degree in?
I was an education major with a social studies history background. That was my first love. When I was in high school, I had some very good priests who taught me, particularly Father Narkin, who gave me my love for history. And from there on in, I became a history buff. And I wound up getting, you know, my degree in education, but with a social studies major.
Kind of like your counterpart over at White Plains High, Fred Singleton, longtime track coach, who wrote a book a few years ago, The Quorum's Child, which kind of foresaw, in a way, the 2020 election to some extent. So you guys, track coaches, history buffs, and great friends together, obviously, too, you and Fred Singleton.
There's another guy, coach, Barry from, God, I'm forgetting his name. He wrote a book also on the Civil War, which I bought for him ceremoniously. He got a book published about the 66th Regiment. Barry. I forgot his last name. But I have the book here in my bookcase. Uh-huh. And I read it. It's all about the regiment's history through the campaigns and the Civil War. It was very, very well done. Mm-hmm. The coach of Irvington.
Now, when you were in high school, what did you do track-wise at Hayes?
I wasn't the fastest, but one thing I did have was a willingness to learn, and I picked up a lot of things. So I did almost every event. I started out as a shot putter, discus, javelin, and then I wound up doing the hurdles, long jump, triple jump. So I did a little bit of everything, but a master of none. You know, I was mainly a shot putter, and that's how I got into big meets with the shot put and the discus. But other than that, if I needed to fill in doing the hurdles or the jumps or whatever, you know, you were only allowed to do one event in those days in the Catholic. So I did one event, and that was I was going to score in the shot put, even though in those days you had to throw over 50 feet. To make the finals in any event. I made the finals one year at 52 feet. I
made
the
finals
one year. Which was the Queens Iona relays. I made the one final, and that was because the major guys were at the Penn relays.
Now, one thing I think people don't understand about track and field at a meet, you don't have to necessarily win. You help accrue points for your team, which goes a long way in helping your team succeed.
That's what attracted me to the sport.
Yeah. So for you, you worked all these different events. You went back and forth. And in college, were you involved in track also, too?
No. I was, like I said, there was no track.
No track at all. Even over at NYU when you went
to. You represented your club. And your football team in intramural activities. And when I had field day, that's the only time I did anything with track.
How did you get into track as a career, coaching track then, if you didn't really have it in college, if there wasn't a school sponsored in college? How did this all come about? Because you became a legend as a coach in the sport.
That's a good story, and it is the basis of everything that happened to me. And I think everything happens for a reason. I started out as a football coach. And when I graduated from college, or while I was in college, I started coaching already at NYU since my eligibility was up after college. You know, I started to coach at George Washington High School. The coach there was a guy named Jim Walsh. I happened to go there one day because I was scouting for a scouting service that I got in a college, a high school buddy of mine was coaching at Fordham Prep, and not coaching, he was coaching at George Washington, and a guy named Frank Furtestadt. And I went scouting a game. I was sitting in the stands, and he came up to the stands, and he said, how would you like to coach? I said, I'd love it. What's happening? He said, come over here and coach our JV, and you can get started doing that. So the next day, I showed that next week, Monday, I showed up, and I started coaching the JV team as a volunteer, so to speak. And the next year, I got hired by Jim Walsh to be the full-time head coach of the JV. I did that from 72 to 76. In 76, I went to Stuyvesant High School as the varsity assistant under Moose Wasserman, the old Dewitt Clinton coach who wound up coaching at Stuyvesant. I did that for a year in 1976. Then he recommended me to coach, be the head coach at James Monroe in the Bronx. Mm-hmm. I was there three years.
Pretty James big Monroe. Program at Monroe.
At the time, it was on a downhill in a way, but they never gave me a job in the building. I wanted to stay there. Right. That was my love. And I'd be a social studies teacher all this time. I was teaching in East Harlem, okay, at the schools that I described before. And then... you know, while I was at Monroe, I said, I can't stay here no more. I'm giving out equipment and these guys disappear. They're stealing equipment. I wasn't there. I didn't know what was going on during the day with these kids because I'm not in the building. Mm-hmm. So I resigned. In that resignation, I helped a friend out coaching at Harry S. Truman High School. And he was coaching. He started the program there in the spring of 1980. Okay. All this time, I started coaching girls track at Stuyvesant. While I was at Stuyvesant from 76 on, I was coaching girls track at Stuyvesant. That was my winter, my spring job. I didn't have a winter indoor job at Stuyvesant. Because the season always, football season always ended Thanksgiving, and the AD didn't want me to coach indoor track while I was coaching football somewhere else. The bottom line is I was coaching girls track, and in 1980, while I was doing the Truman, one day, you know, I moved to New Rochelle in 1977. In 1977, I moved to New Rochelle, and I saw the program. In fact, that they had here in New Rochelle, the football program. And I went to visit the coach one day and gave him my resume. And the summer of 1980, he gives me a call. He says, we got a defensive backfield coach job opening here at New Rochelle. Do you want it? I said, are you kidding me? Of course I want it. Okay. This was in the spring. No, not in the spring. The spring of 79, he told me this. So that fall, 1980, I started coaching New Rochelle High School football. They went undefeated. They were 10-0. They won the state championship of that year. And while I was coaching football, the track coach at New Rochelle High School came up to me. He knew I was coaching track at Stuyvesant. And I said in the beginning, I said, nah, I already got a team at Stuyvesant. You know, after the season's over, I'm going to go down there and coach. So it just so happened that the first day of practice that I went down there to see my kids at Stuyvesant, very few of the kids showed up. When I said later for this, I went up to the AD, Mike Moskowitz, and I went up to him and I said, listen, I got a job offer at New Rochelle High School. I'm going to resign. And he already had somebody in mind to take the job, so that wasn't a problem. So I went up to New Rochelle, and the rest is history. I started coaching girls track the spring of 1980, and I've been there ever since. Coaching football. I coached football there till 1985. In 86, I went to Iona College to coach football. while I was still coaching track at the high
school. What position at Iona did you coach? What position?
Secondary. I was a secondary coach, and then eventually I became the special teams coordinator.
Mm-hmm. Is that a tough job, special teams coordinator? You get to work with everybody on the team pretty much, right?
We had some claims to fame. We kicked a field goal to beat CW Post. I took credit for that. We had a guy named Byron Womack, rest in peace. Byron Womack was a kid who was recruited out of Connecticut. He had originally gone to Norfolk State and, fell down to like sixth position. And he was a kid that was all state in Connecticut. And his father got in touch with me because he knew me from teaching in East Harlem, and his father says, will he be able to play at Iona? I said, sure, he'll be able to play at Iona. And Byron Womack set an NCAA record returning kickoffs. He returned 7 kickoffs in his career for touchdowns.
Wow.
Yeah. That was my thing.
Uh-huh. How do you, as a special teams coach, how do you get all these different personalities who play all these different positions normally, how do you get them to weave together as one special teams unit, whether it's returning punts or kickoffs, blocking on punts and kickoffs? A lot of guys don't like to do that. Chasing on a punt or kickoff, if you're the team that kicks off, I could see that. Playing in many street leagues through the years growing up, I love being on the chase team on a kickoff or a punt because it seemed like you had the whole world in front of you and you could move a guy. You didn't have to be the guy to make the stop, but you can move him into position so somebody else could make the stop. I enjoy doing that, being the first guy down as the gunner.
You were a gunner, huh? Yeah.
Gunner in
you've got to have the mentality for it. You've got to be willing to make that contact. You've got to be hungry for it. So you get the whole thing is motivation, and the team concept. Like they say, offense wins games, defense wins championships or something or another. And then I used to say special teams. Offense wins brings fans. Defense wins games. Special teams wins championships. And if you guys follow the philosophy of the program, we are going to do well. And we did. We did pretty well. But you got to have a mentality for it. The kids got to go, like you just said, you got to be willing to go down there and mix it up, break up the wedge,
right?
Be the one that make contact. Throw that block that's going to spring the guy on the kickoff or on the special teams on the punt return. Mm-hmm. On the punts, make sure you don't get your punts blocked and make sure that the guys don't return back. You got to have a gunner that's willing to go down there and beat the guy that's blocking him. Right. And sometimes it's two. And look to make that contact and make that what we call a spectacular hit. We have the hit of the week on special teams. And if you made a block or you tackled somebody on special teams on a spectacular type of hit, you got the hit of the week, which was a little plaque that they used to get every week.
Mm-hmm. Key to the Jets' first win of the season, which was yesterday, was that block punt early on late in the first quarter, which I thought was a key to the game. It's the second punt block the Jets have had this year. So they seem to be at least pretty good at that. Is the key to on special teams when you kick off, when you punt, and whether or not you're the gunner, whether or not you're the kicker or the punter, stay in your lane, moving downfield, that if you start to run around out of your lane, guys get out of their own lanes trying to make up for what you're doing, and then that can spring the returner in turn?
Well, in college, there's strategies involved. And if you take a look at the film, you'll see when people are blocking, who they are blocking. So you got to tell the kid, this guy is going to block you, look to block you. So I used to do certain things to make sure, if you ever watch a kickoff team, sometimes you see the gunner. Okay, who's blocking the gunners that are going down? Those are the guys that are called, that you want them to be down there first, particularly on the kickoff. And so I used to put them in motion. You'll see some teams that put the guy in motion.
Right.
Sometimes they'll go down the middle. Right. Sometimes they go down straight down the hash. Mm-hmm. And that was my strategy. Keep everything inside the hashes. So the gunners used to go down the hash. But if they were being blocked by certain people, we used to kick directionally, kick kick the ball outside the hash to the left hash. And we used to send both gunners down the left hash to make sure that they kept that guy hemmed in, you know, to the sideline and inside that hash. And then everybody else used to converge on there. You don't have to necessarily stay in your lane. You got to make sure if you're the third guy in, or sometimes the second guy in, I would assign that to make sure nothing gets outside of them on the other hash. Nothing gets outside that hash. That's your job, turn everything in. Mm-hmm. And so you got to strategize. It's not staying in your lane anymore, because they're going to block you. You know, they'll find a way. If you're somebody that's going to be detrimental, if you're the first guy down, they're going to find some way to block you.
Mm-hmm. There's one reason why Giants head coach Joe Judge has been pretty successful so far, even though they've lost their past couple of games after that four-game win streak. They seem to be moving in the right direction. Long-time special teams coach. Is that a key to success overall as a head coach? Should pro and college teams be, even high school teams, be looking more at coaches who have coached special teams because they get to know everybody on the team and who can do what, and they can figure that out? They could have the best special teams coaches can take a backup second, third string, fourth string off a practice squad quarterback and turn him into a special teams guy who contributes to the team.
You could certainly lose games on special teams. You know, you get block punts, block field goals. And definitely, as we have seen, with games on special teams. So I took great pride in that. And then, you know, one day, and I'm going to lead into how I continue coaching now full-time. I wasn't coaching cross-country most of the time because I was doing football. And we had a guy at New Rochelle who was coaching the cross-country team. He was a famous Iona runner by the name of Billy Martin. Okay, Billy Martin was a guy who made the 1980 Olympic team, but it was because of the boycott. He didn't get to go.
Right.
Yeah, but he was a 145 half-miler at Iona, very famous runner. He's now coaching up in New Canaan, Connecticut. But he was coaching our cross-country team at New Rochelle, and then he was my assistant in the winter and the spring. And he called me one day and he said, listen, I'm moving to Connecticut. I'm taking a job up in Connecticut. So I'm leaving cross country.
So he moved on. Yeah.
He moved on, and I moved right into coaching cross country.
I remember him, by the way, and he missed that opportunity in 1980 of going, you know, potentially over being part of the Olympics. I have a cousin who came from East Harlem, family moved down to South Florida, who had a shot to be a gymnast on the 1980 team. And because of the boycott, she never got her shot. Within 2 years, the age of 18, you're considered maybe an elder statesman in gymnastics. And she was babysitting for a couple of the Miami Dolphins kids at that time by 1982, 83. So that was a sad time in this country, I thought, when we missed that opportunity to be part of that Olympics. How did Billy Martin react to that, from what you can recall, by having that opportunity?
He is still the ghost of the 1980 team, still haunts him. Mm-hmm. He's very bitter about it.
40 years later.
Yeah, he's still very bitter about it. He will always use that as his motivation to keep coaching and doing what he needs to do to motivate kids. Mm-hmm. And it motivates him to this day. He started quite a good program up in New Canaan. So he does a very good job in terms of that. Mm-hmm. I hated losing him because he was a good motivator with our cross country program, but it gave me an opportunity to get out of football, because by that time I had left Iona in 1991 because I got a job in the city as a director of an alternative program, and it required me to now no longer give up my Saturdays and Sundays full time. Not getting home late from watching film and this and that. So I had to leave Iona. It was just too much. And going out recruiting, which was another thing that we had to do, to go out and recruit. So an opportunity opened up coaching in 92 or 93 to coach back at New Rochelle High School under Coach Lou D'Arienzo, who you know. And I went to coach with him from 92 to 94. So when Billy left in 94 is when I took over the cross country program. And there now I had full control of the three seasons, cross country, winter, and spring at New Rochelle High School. And that's when I really started my run, because I made my kids, all the kids in the program, run cross country, which was a no-no, as I found out later on as I started to learn, not to make sprinters run cross country because all they do is run slow.
Is there an advantage for sprinters to run cross country? Are there things they can learn by running cross country that they can use in a sprint?
It made them strong. In other words, in track and field, you don't just run one race.
Right.
Particularly if you're a 200-meter runner or 400. 200-meter runners in those days, they had to run the 200, if you were any good, three times at a meet.
Right.
In one day. It wasn't like spread out in 2 days. And if you know anything about the Laux Games in the 1970s and 80s, the Laux Games was brutal. It was under the Olympic program. And if you run a 400, and I had a really good runner back in the 80s, in the 400, she wound up winning in 1982 or 83, the 400. She had to run three rounds.
Back then, yeah.
In the 400, one on Friday night, Saturday morning, and Saturday afternoon. Three rounds of the 400 are brutal. You know, it was like a college runner now, and I'm making this high school junior run these 400s. So it made them strong. I started to get kids that can, they were not only fast, but they can run multiple races. And I had such talent came out on the team. It was unbelievable. Either I bought out the talent, or those kids just prospered. And from like the mid-90s to about 2015, I mean, I was triple crowns almost every year, winning, you know, we won multiple times at the Laux Games,
right?
As you know.
You would win every year at Laux.
We didn't win every year.
Sometimes
Fred bought in a couple of years, he bought in William Penn from Philadelphia, and they would win. And he would bring in some teams sometimes that had some superstars. But, you know, because I, from football, I knew one of the ingredient things, you had to have everything. Like you have offense, defense, and special teams.
Right.
I put my best athletes and spread them around. And if I only had one or two athletes, I made them do multiple events. So if I had a kid like, let's say, Lynn Lane, who's won several times the 100, the 200, and long jump.
Mm-hmm.
Lynn can also hurdle.
Right, that's versatility.
Yeah, I had kids that, my best athletes, I had them be versatile. I also had hired good coaches. I had Natalia Brown, who coached my throwers. Natalia's year in and year out had great shot putters, discus throwers, and now is creating hammer throwers and weight throwers that we've had for the past 10, 12 years. And they would score and win at Laux, and they would win sectionals. Sometimes at sectionals, we'd be losing and either to Suffern or North Rockland, and they looked at the scores and they said, I know those points are coming in from the shot putting the discus. We would get 20 points from the shot and another 20 from the discus, and that was it. The meet was over, you know, and the coaches knew that. So they would, the other coaches, I remember talking to them, the other coaches knew that. And I also, you know, when you go up in the county championships and you go up to this league championships, you have this mass number of points coming in from all your events, hurdlers, sprinters, throwers, jumpers. It was overwhelming. In some cases, some coaches complained that I was always running up the score. It wasn't my intent, you know, to run up the score. You know, I just put my kids in their events and they did well. And,
they have to perform.
And I would tell the coach, I said, I never underestimate, you know, my rivals. I don't underestimate them. So I put everybody in all their events.
Right. And when you put a kid up there, the kid is going to do everything they can do because they have a future to think about, too. You never know who's watching. Might be a college recruiter there in the stands. And, you know, they can get a scholarship or pave the way to higher education and move on to what they really want to do in their lives, too.
Speaking of Lynn Lane was unparalleled as a sprinter in New York at the time that she was running for me. She graduated in 2008. No, 2006. She went on to Tennessee and then transferred to Central Florida. But Lynn Lane won me. It was a league championships. Mount Vernon had this great sprinter. And Lynn Lane in the semifinals of the 200 almost got beat, okay, for advancing to the final by this girl from Mount Vernon. And she had been undefeated and nobody had beaten her locally. And so at the end of the meet, you know, I kind of like railed on her. And the only argument I ever had with Lynn Lane, because she says, you know, like, you want perfection from me all the time, this and that, blah, blah, blah. And I said, it's not perfection. I just don't want you to get complacent and think that you can slow up at the finish line because people are looking to beat you. And that's a feather in their cap. Mm-hmm. And you know, she started crying and this, that. I had to go to her house. That was one of the most memorable moments that I had with Lynn Lane in terms of, you know, her spirit to compete. And on occasion, she would take it easy, you know, and I would have to get on her case. Oh, you can't take it easy. People are looking to beat you. And if they beat you, you know, blah, blah. And most of the runners that I've ever had were always very humble. I've had a few that were egotistic, but most of the runners that I had were very, very humble, starting with Stacy Minot, who won the Laos Games 100.
Yep. I think great runner. Yep.
Four or five times in a row in the 100. Yep. As a seventh, eighth grader, she was winning the 100. Mm-hmm. She was scared out of her mind every time she got up to the starting line. I used to have to boost her ego, like Stacy. These people fear you. What are you fearing them for?
Yet it's good to give that reminder, too, to motivate like that, right? Because, like you say, an athlete can get complacent, especially when they are successful.
Yeah, sometimes they get, you know, so complacent that they just jog through things. And I said, you know, there's something called an effort rule. If you, you know, jog up and jog around and then show up the people who are competing and you're looking back and things like that. That's sportsmanship. You know, you gotta get out there. I'm not saying give your best time. I don't want a best time in your heats and in your semifinals, but you should at least give your best effort in terms to win the race things like that. Unless I tell you to slow up, you shouldn't always give your best effort. And so most of the stars that I've had, I've been very fortunate. I cannot complain about New Rochelle. And a lot of them, you know, I give credit to the kids. They come to practice every day. They work hard. They know what's at stake. Many of them, what's at stake is the tradition. They got to look up. You know, I've had some not so great teams, and the alumni come back. And they give it to them. You know, they said, you're going to be the ones that are going to lose the championship. We haven't lost the league and the counties since 1991. What's the matter with you? Blah, blah, blah. Incidentally, before 1991, the powerhouse in Westchester and in Section 1 was Mount Vernon High School.
Right. I remember. Yep. My early days in the section.
Walter Hall's teams were what my teams became in the 90s and the 2000s. His teams were outstanding. And they set the bar for what I aspired to get to. And, you know, they fell on hard times, you know, recently because of whatever, you know, there was some changes in the coaching staff due to people dying and things like that. So things are not going well at Mount Vernon. They did have, you know, one or two stars, but they're not the teams that they used to be, unfortunately. So our rival now is Ursuline.
Great track program, cross town from you.
Yeah, Jan Mitchell has created a great. I remember when he built that program, his daughter was starting to run for Ursuline, and he started that program somewhere in the mid 90s. And since then, I mean, they've been a rival He beat me a couple of times. He's got great runners there that also were nationally ranked, you know, and I have to live with that, you know, that he has this great program up there. So I have to always be on my toes. Like right now, you know, practicing, I'm always thinking, what does Ursuline have? What does Mount Vernon have? What does my White Plains have? You know, I'm always taking a look at what somebody else has because, you know what, I cannot take it easy at all.
You can't take anything for granted as a coach. You have
no, I don't.
Base every angle.
I don't. One of the biggest things is an upset. The Jets beat the Los Angeles Rams yesterday. You know, if you're not, and you could see that the Los Angeles Rams were not playing up to par. They were not playing their best game. You know, you can see it. You know, they didn't have that. And the same thing with the Giants yesterday.
2 weeks ago in Seattle. Seattle said that we underestimated them. We didn't play
that. You know, and the Giants played the Cleveland Browns, and they made, what's his name, Baker Mayfield look like, you know, he was...
Bart Starr.
Not Bart Starr. The new guy now is the kid from Kansas City, you know.
Patrick Mahomes.
Patrick Mahomes. This kid was completing passes whenever he had to. And you can see the Giants defense was not playing like they played against Seattle. You can see that. You can see. And they were totally out of gas. And so that's what motivates me as a coach, because I knew myself as an athlete, I wasn't the best athlete. So I had to outwork you. I had to like put in, this is what gave me my, you know, you're talking about my philosophy. I have kids on my team that can probably not beat me in a race, you know, but I motivate them. And that's the key issue, what I did with special teams, what I do with my teams. I motivate them to go within themselves, to be better than they really are, or better than they think they are. That's what the key issue, better than you think you are. You're racing against yourself. I don't care if you're a 10-minute miler, as long as you're working to be 9:59. If you're working towards that, then you're okay with me. I don't care if you're last.
As long as you're in the right direction, right?
Yeah, you are working hard. I've had kids who were great athletes who were could have been superstars. They didn't last in my program, because they didn't want to make the sacrifice to come to practice every day. They didn't want to make the sacrifices to work hard when they did come to practice. And, you know, I have a rule. If you don't hit a certain time at practice that I give you, you got to run it again.
Until you get it, until you do it?
Yeah, there's two simple rules that I have, okay, with my team, okay? And first one is be at practice. Second one is finish the practice. Those are the two simple rules. If you're not at practice, you got to make it up on a day that we have off. So on Saturdays when we're not going to meets, I have a list. These kids didn't make practice. You got to come to practice. You know, by the middle of the season, I didn't have makeup days anymore because those kids.
They knew they had to come.
Nobody would miss practice. And if you missed practice during the week and you didn't make it up, you didn't compete till you make it up. So I have a different room now for COVID because I can't, with the kids not going to school, it would be very difficult to have them come to practice all the time. So I don't have that rule anymore. But when they are in school, you're expected to be at practice. If you're not excused from the practice, you're expected to be there. When you're there, this is what you have. If you have 12 200s to do, or if you have 5-mile run, or if you have the weight room, you got to complete the practice. It's not so much as going there now. You got to complete it. And so that's the basis. Once a kid makes it to my senior year, they're golden. Colleges are calling me, you know, because when these kids do go to college, they already have the discipline, you know. So I'll start out with maybe, you know, there'll be right now, I have a list and the numbers are low, but I'll have a list. I have 32 girls signed up for indoor track. It's usually about 70. By the end of the season, I'll be down to about 50. Mm-hmm. And I'll pick up again in the spring. I'll pick up another 15, up to about 65 or whatever. And by the end of the season, I'll be down to like 40, you know, because the rest of them just, I don't cut anybody. They just cut themselves, you know. They
cut themselves. I like that.
They cut themselves, you know. They don't want to practice every day. They don't want to practice doing the things that have to be done when it's hard, you know. And I purposely make it hard, you know. There's certain things that they got to do to prove that they want to be part of this program, and you know, just like people would thrive under being, you know, commandos, Green Berets, Marines. I used to use an expression. Gang members have more loyalty than some of you do. Gang members, you know, like you mess up in a gang, you're done.
Right.
You know, so I'll give a kid a year till they get it together, you know. But once your second year starts and you're still screwing up and you're not doing well in the classroom, you're missing practices, you got attitude issues, you're not getting with your teammates, maybe you should join the chess team. You know, like you want to be part of something, you can't be part of this, you know. And so my seniors, they already know. And so they tell these young kids, this is what you got to do. You know, by sophomore year, we expect a little bit more progress. Junior year, you're golden. Senior year, you're in like Flint. You've done the process. You know, whether it's, you know, so that's why I've had kids, they go to West Point, they go to Yale, they go to Harvard, you know, they succeed. And that's what all the alumni tell me, don't you give up your principles. Don't you give up and take it easy on these girls, because that's what made me. Mm-hmm. You know, a lot of these kids, that they would never have gone on to college and never gotten to do the things they did till they got me getting on their case. Mm-hmm. I get that all the time from some of these girls. Some of the girls already have it. Some of the girls already got that. But many of them who have never been on teams before, they don't know what it takes to be a member of a team like that. The camaraderie, the work ethic, and the pride. I call it the pride to be on a program like New Rochelle. You know, so when Caps girls get together, that's all they talk about. You remember running up that hill? Oh my God, he made us go up there 9-10 times. Oh my God. And then we screwed up on the last one. We had to do it again.
Coach Andy Campion from New Rochelle High School, longtime track and field coach. Now, in our final few minutes here, we have the 2020 indoor season, 2021 indoor season set and ready to go as we wrap up 2020 here. First of all, during the fall, did the New Rochelle track program participate in anything, cross country, et cetera?
Yes, we had a cross country season, which 20 girls came out and, you know, 15 to 16 of them came by and large every day doing what they had to do. We had one really good runner who made all section. We didn't win too many matches because Ursuline and Scarsdale and those White Plains had some very good teams this year in cross country. But the kids were dedicated. They came in, you know, trying to run their best times. And I said, that's all that matters. You're trying to run your best times. We were stifled a little bit in the beginning because, you know, the COVID protocol at New Rochelle didn't allow us to go anywhere. So we had to run dual meets at New Rochelle High School around the lakes. And we went up a couple of times to Iona Prep to run up against Ursuline. They made a course around Iona Prep. But we weren't allowed to go anywhere until November. We wound up going up to Milton, where most of the section was running up in Milton, New York. Mm-hmm. Ran up there twice. But most of the time, we were stuck in Westchester. We weren't allowed to go anywhere.
Now, here you got the outdoor season wrapping up here cross country, and you have now the indoor track season. January 4th is supposed to be the launch date for the so-called winter sports to have their first day of practice. Do you see that happening at this point, or is it still up in the air in your own mind?
I would say I'm more inclined to think that they'll delay it again. Already some sections, I know Section 3 has canceled their season. Some high schools in Long Island have canceled their indoor season. A good friend of mine coaches at Uniondale, who's also a very good program, Lee Paulette. The school itself has canceled their indoor season.
Mm-hmm.
I'm grateful if New Rochelle doesn't cancel the indoor season, but I'll understand if they do, because this COVID thing is really troubling. We need to get a grip on it. Hopefully the vaccinations that they propose to give us within the next 6-7 months will get this cleared up. And right now, I do not think that we'll start January 4th, but I'm planning on it.
Mm-hmm.
Most New Rochelle High School students are due back January 19th. So hopefully Section 1 and the state will say, no, we'll go with January 4th for the low-risk sports.
Mm-hmm.
I know basketball, wrestling, and cheerleading are considered high-risk sports. They might be delayed. But our low-risk sports, like bowling.
Right.
And indoor track,
right?
And I forgot the other sport. Do not need to be delayed. You know, you can start January 4th.
How are you changing around your practice routines now as you get ready for January?
Well, I spend the first 10-15 minutes making sure that I take every kid's temperature, that I record that they're at practice, that I'm asking them for. In the beginning, I did it, you know, a lot more. Efficiently, where we ask them 4 questions. Did you leave the state? Did you know anybody who's had contact with, have you had contact with somebody who's had COVID and things like that? And so all I do now is ask them, has anything changed since I last asked you those questions? Because I would spend an inordinate amount of time asking 25 to 30 kids.
Right. You wouldn't be able to practice. You just have to paper. Yeah.
So, you know, and then I got to record it and then give a copy of that to the AD, Steve Young. And I got to make sure that, and I hate to say it, but the kids don't always socially distance. You know, they stretch together. They want to warm up together. They got to wear their mask. But when they stretch, they are far apart. But when they come in and meet in that practice, they're standing around waiting to answer the questions for me. So I said, socially distance, girls, move apart, you know, things like that. But then once practice starts, you know, I break them up into their groups, and that's easier to do. A lower risk, but I'll have a group of 4 or 5 kids doing this, another 4 or 5 doing that, and they rotate. So things go much easier once practice starts.
What's the plan for springtime at the moment when we have the Laux games at White Plains High School that you referred to and others, so many important meets that take part during spring?
Well, I'm hoping that spring is spring, but it is starting later than normal. So normal meets that we have gone to might not be there. For example, in every April, you always look forward to the Penn Relays, which we missed last year. We don't start spring track to the middle of April. You know, so maybe even May, if everything is delayed. So we're going to miss the Penn Relays. You know, right now, I'm planning on a spring season. But if that doesn't start till mid-April or early May, you're only going to have May, June. So it's going to be like an abbreviated season.
That's what I think it's going to be for springtime sports from what I've heard. May and June. It's going to be all cramped into
May and June. I don't even know if they'll have a football season. I know football coaches have been planning and they've been trying to practice on a regular basis in terms of 2 or 3 times a week doing some conditioning. But, you know, it's tough. You know, I canceled practice Saturday morning. It was too cold.
Right.
We can't work out in the building. I can't go to the weight room to use the treadmill. So I canceled practice. It was too cold. I could imagine, you know, winter season making those decisions, even if we did have school, but the AD don't let us run in the building. I'm not going to work out outside in 20-degree weather. I'm sorry. I'm not going to put these kids through that worried about COVID and pneumonia or a cold or the flu, the parents will go up in arms, you know. So I have to make decisions in regarding everyday practice with these kids. I might only practice 2 or 3 times a week. Will that hurt our efficiency? It sure will.
You've had a 40-year coaching career, and a little over that, actually, because you had that first conversation back in 79. How much longer does Andy Capion see himself doing this? Forever until the end of time, we hope?
Truth be spoken, last year when spring was canceled, I stayed home, right? And I was like already saying at the end of the winter season that I was tired, that I was going to make the spring my last season. So sitting at home, isolated, like President Trump would accuse Biden of hiding in his basement. Well, I was hiding at home. I wasn't doing anything, not going anywhere. And so I was bored stiff, okay? In fact, when you see me, I lost 50 pounds.
I lost 35.
Yeah, I could see it in your face. I lost 50 pounds. I started walking 5 to 7 miles a day. I started eating right and taking care of myself. It started over the summer. But I said to myself, you know, there's something missing. Not going somewhere, not having meets on Saturdays, not working towards goals with these kids. That's another thing. We set goals. Where I sat down with kids. I had a kid that graduated last spring who was looking to break the school record and a triple jump. This girl named Chiamaka Odenebo, who's up at Brown now, and they're paused. So she's living in Boston now with her sister who goes to, what's that school, Northeastern. So she's living up there to wait until January, hopefully Brown starts. But, you know, we were working towards goals, and they didn't come about. So I told the girls in a Zoom meeting, we had a Zoom meeting, and I said, girls, I told you before that I might quit at the end of the spring season. It ain't happening. I'm coming back. And
you got me forever, right?
From here on now, I'm retired from teaching and administrating and this and that. I was a college professor for 10 years. After I gave up my job at North Rochelle High School as a assistant principal, I said, I got to stay coaching. So as long as I can walk, which is not very well these days, I will do the best I can. Maybe at 75, I'm 72 now. Maybe I'll stay in it to 75 if I stay healthy. I don't want to not do something, even if I'm coaching just one event.
Right.
You know, because that's what keeps me going. You know, I set goals for a kid and it's a contract. I always say there's a contract between me and the kid. I ask them, every new kid that comes in, do you want to just be good or you want to be great? And they all inevitably say great. I said, well, you heard of a coach bus? Well, I'm the coach. I'll get you there. All you have to do is do everything I tell you to do. Not that I'm a control freak, but I've gotten people where they want to go.
Uh-huh.
So if you want to go somewhere with your goals in terms of being an athlete, just follow what I tell you to do. You might take a year or two, but I'll make you the best that I can be. Whether you're going to be a 10-minute miler or you're going to be a 5-minute miler, just follow the program. And that's what I do with them.
As a track coach, you have that track record of success.
Yes.
There you go. Andy Capion.
And hope to continue.
Without a doubt, we know that. And I can't ever imagine you doing anything else. So stay with it forever, okay? I mean that seriously.
Thank
Andy
you.
Capion, track and field.
And it's good to know that you're in East Harlem. My goodness.
Yeah.
Wow.
Right up the block from each other we grew up. You know, we had other people around the neighborhood.
Maybe we threw bottles at each other for
a
while. We're different.
Basketball against each other or... You know, an inadvertent elbow you might have gotten might have come from, like my father would say, come and watch me play.
If I played basketball, it was usually at different gyms.
Right.
At 116, at night, they had a night center. At 120, junior high school, 120 on 120th Street.
Yeah, yep.
120 on 120th Street, they had a night center. So. Yep. You know, tournaments, games, or what have you, you know, I was there playing basketball. But we're different eras. I think you're like, what? How old are you? Like 62?
64, I just turned.
64. So we're different eras.
8 years apart, but we may have crossed paths along the way. I went to kindergarten down the block from Wagner there on 120th Street, Holy Rosary. I went to kindergarten there before St. Anne's when I lived over Patsy's in 118th Street. So even there, we were on the same block almost at the same time, a few years apart. On the basketball course, my father would come and watch me play around the neighborhood, and he'd always say, you know, it's amazing how some of the most important parts of the game, somebody be driving on you, your elbow would come up by accident all the time, right? just moving around there. You move your body around, body parts. Okay.
I remember one year we played a pickup football game at Jefferson Pools Field right next to that. Uh-huh.
Yep, in the park. They still go there.
Against Montcalma, Our Lady of Montcalma. Mm-hmm. And they had a quarterback there in my era who was fabulous. He was a short little guy, but man, he was like Fran Tarkenton. He was always running, and I was chasing him around all over the place. I could never catch up. When I did catch up to him, I got a penalty for roughing him. But yeah, we played Our Lady of Mount Carmel. They had a great quarter. I don't know his name, but he was, I'll always remember when you mentioned Mount Carmel, that was it. Our Lady of Mount Carmel.
I played on the fields there at Jefferson Park into the mid-80s, matter of fact. Yep. So I still go there to watch soccer sometimes, too. Got a lot of teams from
That's all they do there
West
now.
Side. A lot of guys come from West Africa, and they have leagues there in Jefferson. I go to watch sometimes. Guys from Senegal and Chad and Guinea. And
I haven't been down there in that neighborhood ages. Ages.
You should come down sometime. You'll remember the streets, every crack in the street, everything you remembered as a kid. You won't forget.
Ages.
I don't. Yeah, I don't. Love going back all the time. Andy, always a pleasure to talk with you. Always love talking to you. And I hope we have the Laux games at White Plains High this year and we'll get to talk there or another venue again. All the best to you. I know you got to get out there.
When are they going to air this?
Get some coaching together and get it done today too, right? Got practice coming up today?
Yes.
Yeah.
When is this going to air?
When is this going to air? This is going to air as soon as we produce it up together, our production department. We put it up on our Westchester Talk Radio website. We give you a copy of it. We put it all over social media, matter of fact, too, all different kinds of social media. So we get exposure all over. I have a good friend over in Brooklyn who posts it and gets some. She puts up some of my shows, and we get worldwide coverage because she's got a lot of contacts like in Eastern Europe and in Asia and different places. So we go all over. We can do that today with this technology.
Okay, looking forward to it.
Same
All right. Here. Thank you for having me. I'm honored. Thank you very much.
Honored to have you, Andy. Much appreciated. Thank you, Andy Papillon. You're Rochelle High School legendary track and field coach here at Westchester Talk Radio, westchestertalkradio.com. I'm John Marino, and we are made possible by Entergy, the Indian Point Energy Center, supporting our communities through April of 2021. Also by Wartburg Healthcare and Rehabilitation in Mount Vernon, Park Sterling Realty in Bronxville, and Michael Labriola, Landscape Design and Construction in Armonk. And catch all of our Westchester, Fairfield County, Putnam and Dutchess talk radio programming on our YouTube channel. That is Shark Creative YouTube. Thank you, Andy.
You're listening to Westchester Talk Radio.
Powered by Shark Media, a division of Shark Creative.
And made possible by Entergy, Indian Point Energy Center.
Visit SafeSecureVinyl.com.